Tonight on Arena, just how good is the CAA at writing four-minute power ballads? And If It Bleeds, a quartet of new stories from Stephen King. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The anthem adopted to celebrate the fall of communism and the peaceful reunification of Germany, or a secret CIA propaganda tool which fooled the masses? That's the question being asked about the Scorpions' 1990 hit Wind of Change in a new 8-part podcast series also entitled Wind of Change. It's available to enjoy in full right now on Spotify, and it's written and presented by New Yorker columnist and prominent investigative journalist Patrick Radden Keefe. We'll talk to Patrick shortly, but first, let's hear some of the song that whetted his investigative appetite from the album Crazy World, Wind of Change, from the Scorpions.
Follow the Moskva down to Gorky Park, listening to the wind of change.
Wind of Change from the Scorpions, or should I say from the CIA, because that, as I said, is the question being asked in the new 8-part podcast series, also entitled Wind of Change, written and presented by Patrick Radden Keefe, who joins me now from New York. Patrick, people here might know you from your 2019 book, Say Nothing, which used the disappearance of Jean McConville as the starting point to investigate atrocities carried out in Northern Ireland, or indeed your work around the opioid crisis, particularly in your own country. Now, a conspiracy theory around the CIA writing a power ballad to reunify Germany doesn't quite sound as if it's in the same serious investigative ballpark.
Bit of a change of tune, eh? Yeah. You know, it's funny. I spent a good chunk of the last 5 years working on this book, Say Nothing, about the Troubles, a fairly grim subject matter. And this podcast was the first thing I did coming out of that. I had gotten this crazy tip years ago from a trusted source that he'd heard from somebody at the CIA, that the CIA had actually written that song. And so that started me off on this this journey. And it was a very nice, I mean, this, you know, the stakes are somewhat lower, as you say. So it was a very fun thing to do.
Yeah, but those are very investigative journalist words. I got this tip from a trusted source. Now, you can tell me a little bit about the source, really, because he's a very good pal of yours, and you admit to who that source is, well, part of the source, if you like, in the very first episode of the podcast series, in fact.
Yeah, so there's this guy, my friend Michael, who's a bit of an international man of mystery himself. He works for Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State for the U.S., but he's also very involved in international business, and he's done business intelligence work over the years, and he knows a lot of spies. And he's a dear old friend of mine, but over the years, he has fed me little tidbits occasionally that have blossomed into stories for me. And so I tend to take anything he tells me pretty seriously. And in this instance, I was doubly intrigued because the guy who related the story to him, this ex-CIA guy, is somebody who I've also met. I had met this guy through him. And so someone who, you know, I had a bit of a feel for, and I had a sense this guy was not a, you know, he wasn't somebody to fabricate such a story.
Yeah. Now, I don't know how much Irish you learned during your time here, but there's a saying in the Irish language which goes, Dirchban lum, gnirchban lehi, which basically means, a woman told me that a woman told her. You can go on and on. That a man told her that his brother did this, and it was his uncle that actually was the source of the story in the beginning. And we might come back to how reliable Michael indeed, perhaps, and Oliver might be. We'll come back to all of that. But let's get a sense of Wind of Change itself. The song. Now, you can hear it in the lyrics there. Did you ever think that we could be so close, like brothers? The future's in our hands, you know, can feel it everywhere. Take me to the magic of the night. All of, you know, we're looking at very exciting events. How important was it, and how linked was it, in fact, to the reunification of Germany?
Well, so the song, to get into the specifics of the song, it was written actually before the wall came down, but it wasn't released until afterwards. So what happened is that the band, the Scorpions, had gone and played in Moscow in the summer of 1989, which was quite a big thing because rock and roll had effectively been banned in the Soviet Union during the Cold War. There was a sense that the Kremlin had that it was quite dangerous to communist control, obviously very associated with the West. But there was a bit of opening up, and the band had gone to Moscow in the summer of 89. And then after that, they record this song. And the song becomes kind of an anthem for the reunification of Germany, but then also very, very influential among young people in the Soviet Union. And it kind of spreads like wildfire. It goes to number one on the charts all across Europe in 91. And really is the soundtrack, once the wall has fallen, to the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So it was, for me, looking into it, it actually makes a certain amount of sense that it would dovetail with U.S. interests. But also going, which I did for the podcast, I mean, going to St. Petersburg and Moscow and Ukraine and interviewing fans to a degree that I perhaps didn't fully appreciate. The song is not just a song for them. It's this massive cultural and political touchstone.
Of course, that's still a long way off the CIA writing it for it to become exactly that, or indeed for it to have the effect of reunifying Germany. That's a pretty powerful thing for any piece of music to do. But if you wanted to add to the conspiracy theory element of this, the song itself and the album indeed, Crazy World, the album from which it comes, this was a change from the norm for the Scorpions, both in terms of the songwriting process and where the album was recorded. So maybe the CIA spooks did get to them and pull them to the one side and say, here, come here, let's do this together. It kind of feeds into that, doesn't it?
It does. But I mean, this was the whole experience for me of chasing down this story. You know, normally you hear a story like that, and as you say, it's a woman told me that a woman told her. It's got this kind of third hand quality. You know, the expression journalists would sometimes use is it's too good to check. And I get stories like that all the time. I mean, they come to me in my inbox. People tip me off to things and I'll kind of look at them and kick the tires. And usually it just seems like there's less there, you know, than it seemed at first. This is one of these funny stories where the more I dug into it, you would have thought the less plausible it would seem, but the more I dug, the more plausible it seemed. And so some of it is the kind of thing you're getting at, where it turns out Klaus Meine, who wrote the song, didn't usually write songs. This was quite different, in fact, than all the other songs that the Scorpions had been writing for years. They weren't really a political band per se. They were kind of an 80s hair metal act with all the preoccupations that would imply. And suddenly they go political. And they record the album for the first time in the States with an American producer. And so it was that kind of thing where as I looked into it, and also as I looked into the history of the CIA, you know, initially I thought, what could they ever have to do with music? But of course, it turns out the CIA was very active during the Cold War in promoting certain types of culture because they thought that it would, be a threat to Soviet ideology.
And in fact, you know, if you were in a court of law arguing a point here, you'd be looking for precedent. And you give us the precedent of Marlene Dietrich in the 1940s and indeed Nina Simone a little bit later on. Just remind us of how you would argue they were used for propaganda purposes previously.
Yeah. So even before the CIA is established during World War II, when the predecessor agency was the OSS, Marlene Dietrich, who by that point was a Hollywood actress and singer, and had renounced her German citizenship, she recorded propaganda songs, basically in German, that the Allies could broadcast across Germany to try and demoralize the Nazi troops. And so Dietrich did this knowingly. She put out an album eventually called Songs I Sang for the OSS. She was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And I had not known any of this history. The more interesting case to me is later. And it's an artist who I grew up listening to and have always loved, Nina Simone, the High Priestess of Soul. in 1961, goes to Nigeria on a tour that was sponsored by this foundation in Washington. And the idea is that it's kind of African-American artists going to Africa and linking up with African artists. And Simone was quite politically radical. She was not a fan of the U.S. government and ended up actually leaving and living in Europe, kind of turning her back on the States. But we found out that the foundation that sent her was a front for the CIA. So she had been used as a pawn, and she died not knowing it.
I think it's probably a good thing that she died not knowing that, if, in fact, you're saying you have the proof of it somewhere that that is what actually happened, because she just would have balked at the idea that she was a pawn for the CIA or for the U.S. government in any way, I would have thought.
Absolutely. I mean, she was, you know, her politics were very, very radical. There's a wonderful story that her longtime guitarist told us in the podcast about when the two of them met Martin Luther King, and Nina Simone saw him coming, and from a distance she saw him, and she said to him, "I ain't nonviolent." That was the way she introduced herself to Dr. King.
What a brilliant double negative that is. And you know, the political climate is important when we think, particularly around the Scorpions and their trip, their journey to Russia behind the Iron Curtain in 1989. It was a big festival that was organized, wasn't it?
Yes. So this is another big part of the story, is that for years it had been impossible, really, for Western acts and rock acts to play Russia, to play Moscow. And then what happened is that in the summer of 89, they have this huge historic rock festival, kind of like Woodstock, but in Moscow, the Moscow Music Peace Festival. And it's the first time that this sort of thing has happened. And the thing that's funny and makes this a bit of a period piece is that most of the bands were these hard rock or heavy metal bands. Those were the kind of cultural ambassadors that were sent to perform in this at this huge Russian show. And the Scorpions were one of those bands.
Yeah, the Scorpions were one of those bands. And Ozzy Osbourne was also involved. And let's listen to a clip we found of Ozzy Osbourne speaking about that particular festival and what he saw in Russia and how it upset him.
It's a beautiful country, it really is. It's just the people in it are so miserable. I mean, what it does make me appreciate is what we have in the West. I mean, that you can't get toilet paper here, you can't get toothbrushes here, you can't buy soap. I saw a great big line of people yesterday as we were driving in for a cabbage, you know. I mean, that's ridiculous.
So there you go, Ozzy Osbourne there. I think I may have claimed we found that. Is that from the podcast itself?
It is from the podcast, yeah.
I beg your pardon.
I was very pleased you played that, because there's plenty of, you know, just when you're afraid it's getting too serious, we try and spike the punch with a bit of Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah, well, he's always good to get us laughing. I mean, I find myself laughing out loud at the preposterous nature of this from time to time. You know, the idea that this could actually happen, you know. Now, I don't want to give anything away here, and I won't say how and where this occurs, but there is a point when we do hear from Klaus Meine himself, and we hear you ultimately putting a really important question to him. I'm not interested really in what he says here. I'm interested in the pause before he says anything. Let's just listen.
Klaus hasn't touched any of the snacks or drinks we ordered for him, but he seems relaxed, leaning back in his chair, like he's having a pleasant time. Or at least, like he doesn't mind going through the motions. But now, it's time to ask him if he's ever been an agent for the CIA. We heard a rumor that there was some kind of connection between the CIA and your band.
No.
Have you ever heard anything like
that?
No?
No. No.
You've never heard that?
Never heard that.
Connection in all these years.
Between the CIA.
Some kind of connection.
And the band.
I mean, specifically, it was that there was some sort of connection between the CIA and that song, Wind of Change.
No. Really?
Yeah.
Tell me the story.
Well, so the story was that they had something to do with the creation of the song, somehow.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, come on.
You've never heard this?
No, I never heard
that. Are you surprised?
I'm very much surprised. This is new.
Klaus Meine there in a clip from Wind of Change. How many times, I should have done this before we come, how many times does he say no?
In that? And with a different inflection each time.
And like any good actor, he leaves a pause before he says anything.
He left a very long pause. Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you played that because the for me, you know, you can imagine Klaus Meine had become like the Wizard of Oz, right? On some level, he's this guy that I've been obsessing over for years and just gathering all this evidence. I sometimes thought it was as if I was spying on him. Hmm. And then I came in and I posed the question. And on the one hand, you know, he denies it. And of course, if it were true, he would deny it.
Yeah.
If it's not true, he would deny it. And then he did it in this wonderfully enigmatic way.
Well, I think it's a phenomenal performance, if it is a performance on his part, or else it's he was phenomenally taken aback, and that could well be the case as well. So I'll come back to then this my Durchbahn Lumge, Durchbahn Lehi theory, and I know you touch on this in the podcast as well. But your friend Michael, I mean, you, let's face it, Patrick, have dealt with the intelligence community in the past, and you've investigated the intelligence community in the past in your very serious investigative journalism work. What if the CIA, in fact, said to Michael, who is a CIA operative for these purposes, do you know what we need you to do now? Would you get to that Keefe guy? Would you get him off our backs? Would you lead him up some, you know, wild, on some big goose chase? Oh, look, tell him that Wind of Change, tell him we wrote that. Yeah. Tell him the CIA wrote that and get him to spend 10 years working on that. That'll occupy him for a while. Do you think there's a possibility that your friend Michael...
Believe me, the thought has occurred to me. I mean, this is the thing: is when once you open the door to this kind of thinking, then anything's possible. And part of what I was trying to capture in the podcast, hopefully in a fun way, is that it's all a bit of a hall of mirrors, right? Once you start asking these questions, it could be that, you know, that somebody got to Michael and Michael's telling me stories, or somebody got to Oliver and Oliver's telling Michael stories. Or somebody got to the guy who told the story to Oliver. And you just begin to question everything and wondering, you know, always, who's the secret agent in the room?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's exactly the feeling I had. And I had a lot of fun getting that feeling. Real privilege and joy to speak with you this evening. That's Patrick Radden Keefe there speaking to us about all 8 episodes of Wind of Change. They're available to listen to now on Spotify. Well, not right now. Wait until we're finished, please. The series is also available on other platforms where it is being released weekly on an episode by episode basis.